It's time to take the quiz.
5 questions, 5 minutes a day, 5 days a week.
Take the quiz every weekday at thequiz.fox and then listen to the quiz podcast to find out how you did.
Play, share, and of course, listen to the quiz at thequiz.fox.
I'm Shannon Bream. The Federal Reserve's moves to cool the red-hot economy rattle markets as Americans feel the financial strain.
The current picture is plain to see, and inflation is much too high.
Increased rates meaning borrowers will pay more for loans for homes and cars, while national gas prices hover around $5 a gallon.
Inflation. It's sapping the strength of a lot of families.
We'll ask the president's chief economic advisor, Brian Deese, whether the solution could spark a new set of problems.
We all made a commitment to each other that we were supportive of the framework.
There are a couple of issues that need to be settled.
Stalled negotiations over gun reform as talks spill into the weekend with a deadline to hold votes next week looming. We will ask Republican Senator Mike Lee whether the bill is in jeopardy. Plus, more questions about President Joe Biden's prospects for another term. We'll ask our Sunday panel what it means if the mainstream media and Democrats abandon him. Fox News Sunday is on the road to the midterms. We'll take you to a small-town Virginia diner where patrons are trying to bridge political divides. All right now on Fox News Sunday. Hello again and happy Father's Day from Fox News in Washington. There are growing concerns this week over the economy as the Federal Reserve made its biggest hike since 1994, aiming to curb soaring inflation. The stock market seeing its worst week since the beginning of the pandemic, with the Dow falling below 30,000 for the first time since January 2021. The president says recession isn't inevitable, and he's pledging to go to war with big oil to lower prices at the pump, telling energy executives to produce more, while critics say he's pointing fingers at a situation he helped create. In a moment, we ask the U.S. National Economic Council Director Brian Deese about the administration's challenges. But first, let's turn to Lucas Tomlinson live at the White House for more on the increasing pressure to do something to curb rising prices. Lucas.
Shannon, President Biden taking aim at the oil industry as gas prices remain at record-setting levels nationwide.
They can drill, but they're not doing it.
President Biden threatening oil companies with, quote, emergency powers if they don't boost supply to lower gas prices. Exxon firing back, saying in a statement the White House can promote investment through clear and consistent policy. American refiners say they're already operating at near max capacity, roughly 95%. According to the Oil and Gas Journal, U.S. oil production in May now within 3% of January's 2020 record high before the pandemic.
The fact that they're pumping more than they ever have before and they have so many leases available to them suggests that they have the ability to pump more.
The American people are bracing for a very pricey summer, and they know exactly who to blame.
Half the country blames Biden for the spike in gas prices. About 3 in 10 Americans blame Putin. To bring down inflation, the Federal Reserve conducted the largest rate hike in nearly 30 years.
We at the Fed understand the hardship that high inflation is causing.
Higher interest rates means Americans will pay more to borrow money.
The inflationary pressures that we're seeing in the country today have everything to do with the president and his policies, and the American people are paying the price for that.
The White House and top Democratic lawmakers are in talks to pass more legislation to fight inflation, in addition to those gun control measures. Shannon.
Lucas Tomlinson reporting from the White House. Lucas, thank you. And joining us here in Washington, Brian Deese, director of the National Economic Council. Brian, welcome back to Fox News Sunday. Good to have you.
Happy to be here.
Okay, so let's look at some of the polling and seeing how Americans are feeling about the economy this morning. Fox News asked, do you feel optimistic or pessimistic? 32% optimistic, 65% pessimistic. And that has been, you know, tracking the numbers, unfortunately, moving in the wrong direction. The condition of the economy, 82% of people say it's only fair or poor. And then we asked people a personal question. How is this impacting you and buying things like gas prices? 90% say it's a problem for them. 88% say grocery prices. Utility costs, 81%. The president this week asked Americans to have confidence in the economy. They clearly don't, though.
Well, look, we get it. When you drive up to the pump and you see the prices that we have today, it creates uncertainty and it creates real economic hardship. But at the same time, it is important as Americans that we recognize the unique strengths that we have in this economy. The strongest labor market since World War II, unemployment at 3.6%, household balance sheets that have repaired over the course of the last year. So we now have the lowest mortgage delinquencies in 15 years, the lowest credit card delinquencies in 30 years. Those are sources of strength that are unique to the American economy. We have a stronger and better position to tackle inflation than almost any other country around the world, but that's what we need to do now. And the president has made very clear that fighting inflation, bringing down prices, is his top economic priority. He's using the tools that he has, and he's calling on Congress to pass legislation that would help to accelerate this process of bringing down prices without giving up all of the economic gains that we've made.
So Bloomberg reporting on this advanced negotiations that you have going on with folks on Capitol Hill, Democrats, this name that always comes up as a fly in the ointment for you guys, which is Senator Joe Manchin. He's actually getting praise from people across the political spectrum for blocking Build Back Better, as even the Fed has said that contributed to inflation potentially to the tune of 3 percentage points. How is this going to factor in for you now with Manchin and these new negotiations? What can you get done?
Well, I'm going to leave the negotiations where they are, not talk about them here. But what I'll say substantively is what are we talking about right now? We're talking about some concrete measures to lower costs that typical families are facing. Take Medicare prescription drugs. We can lower those costs by allowing Medicare to negotiate for better prices. That actually reduces federal spending and reduces costs paid by consumers. Lowering energy bills, utility bills with common sense tax credits, and reducing the deficit. Reducing the deficit with long overdue tax reform. Economists across the spectrum agree that if we take those steps, it'll be complementary to what the Fed is trying to do. Not only help to lower prices, but also send a signal to the market and the world that the United States is focused on this issue and is committed to bringing prices down, again, without giving up all of the extraordinary economic gains that we've made.
So what's a timeline for getting those things to a vote? We have an August recess coming. We have midterms coming that could potentially change the makeup of what you all control on Capitol Hill and can get done.
Well, those conversations are happening. I'm going to leave them to the leadership. What I would say is we're hopeful, and we really want to see something move here in the short term. Because, again, this is not just about enacting legislation. It's about giving some relief to families right now and sending a signal that not just the president and the Federal Reserve, but Congress recognize that fighting inflation needs to be our top priority.
Okay, so let's talk about the possibility of recession. It continues to seem to be a growing real possibility. Steve Rattner, who was part of the Obama-Biden administration, said the Fed is going to hike interest rates. Obviously, that has happened. But he said to get from where we are back to that goal of 2% inflation, the Fed's never done it without a recession. Now, he's not the only one talking about this. Growing number of U.S. CEOs also think that is the problem. The Wall Street Journal reporting this, it says more than 60% of CEOs expect a recession in their geographic region in the next 12 to 18 months. And they go on to say that a business research team finds that an additional 15% think that the region of the world where their company operates is already in a recession. So 75% of top business executives think we're there or we're about to be there.
Well, look, a lot of things about the economy right now are unique. We've also never been in a situation where we've had 3.6% unemployment and the record level of job openings, 11 million job openings right now, which means there's a lot of incumbent strength in the labor market that puts us in a good position. But I talked with CEOs this week from sectors across the American economy, and what I hear from them is that we are moving through a transition. Americans are spending less money on goods at home. They're spending more money on services. For some companies, that's a real challenge. For others, it's an opportunity. The housing market is recalibrating after record home price increases, which have meant, by the way, if you're a typical homeowner, you have probably $50,000, $60,000 in additional equity in your home. But we need to bring those house price increases down, and that's going to filter through the economy. But as we move through this transition, not only is a recession not inevitable, but what we as policymakers can do is take steps to build on our unique strengths in the American economy and try to get to that stable and steady growth that we all want to get to as quickly as possible. So when you hear us talking about these policy measures, it's because what we can do right now is send a signal that we all get it, that inflation has to be our top economic priority. But there are things that we can do. There are tools that we can deploy. There are steps that we can take right now.
So let's talk about the issue of taking responsibility. Here's what the president said back in 2020 during the campaign. He said, it's hard to believe that this has to be said, but unlike this president, referencing President Trump, I'll do my job and take responsibility. I won't blame others. In fact, it was a hallmark of his campaign. Here's a bit of his campaign ad to that point.
The buck stops here. Harry Truman said it. It means no excuses, It means taking responsibility, the ultimate responsibility, for the biggest decisions in the world.
New York Post opinion piece put it this way this week. They said, Biden alternates between claiming credit for everything good that happens in America and swearing to be an innocent bystander to an economy going off the rails. So does the buck stop with the president or not?
Of course it does. And I think you've seen this president consistently stand up and give it straight to the American people, explain to them the challenges and the opportunities and, importantly, his plan going forward. You know, when Putin began amassing troops on the Ukrainian border, the president stood up and said clearly, this war will not be without costs, but we must defend democracy. We must hold the Western order. And Democrats and Republicans stood with him as well. Now he is saying we have global economic challenges. We have energy prices that are set globally. That's not an excuse. That's a reason why we need to focus on the steps that we can take here at home to produce more supply of energy in the short term and also provide some relief to American families in the short term as well.
So let's talk about that, because the president has taken aim at President Putin. He has, and by the way, inflation was fourfold from when he took office to when the invasion of Ukraine began. But now he's going after the oil companies at a time when you all need to be working together. It appears to be a bit antagonistic at this point. Here is what he said to fossil fuel companies, to oil companies on the campaign trail back in 2019. This was his message.
I guarantee you, we're going to end fossil fuel, and I am not going to cooperate with you, okay?
Okay, you are a numbers guy. Would any sane executive invest tens of billions of dollars into infrastructure that the president has said he's going to destroy?
Well, let's talk about some numbers first. Today, America is the largest producer of oil and gas in the world. This month, we're producing 12 million barrels of oil. That's higher than the average under the prior president.
Well, actually, 2019 was the peak.
It then came down precipitously during COVID and has now come back. But we are a net exporter of oil. We actually produce more oil than we consume.
Okay,
and
send
the rest.
Let me stop you there and give you a chance to answer this, because Yahoo Finance has a real in-depth piece about this. And their headline is The Myth of Energy Independence. They say, with regard to oil, the main component in gasoline, the U.S. consumes more than it produces. Flatly stated, the U.S. is not oil independent in terms of raw crude. And I know there are a lot of different definitions we could use here. The U.S. has long been a net importer. They say it still is.
Well, there's a lot of different definitions and types of crude. The reality is we are a net exporter of oil. But more important than that for the immediate term is what we can do to increase supply. As you said, supply came down precipitously during COVID. We want to see that come back and come back online. In the near term, the companies have a very powerful market incentive. Prices are high and their profit and profit margins are high. And what we are encouraging is that they take those and put those profits to work to increase production. But over the medium term, this is very important. The president's policy has always been a transition to clean energy. And that means building on the strengths of our energy system and also following the science. And the science shows that even with very ambitious climate targets that this president is committed to, oil will continue to be a part of our economic equation this decade and the next. They have a medium-term incentive to invest as well. And in fact, many of those companies have committed to that same transition. Many of those companies have similar net zero targets. So what we are encouraging, and the president's secretary of energy will be meeting with companies over the course of this week, is let's get pragmatic steps in the near term. You know, the Dallas Fed did an interesting study. They asked all of these energy executives, what is keeping you from doing this? 94% of them said something other than government regulations. But what we're saying is, if there are places where the federal government can take a practical and responsible step in the immediate term, we're open. We're open to hearing them.
Okay, well, you know, the industry has given you a list of those. They say that their refineries in the U.S. right now are producing at or near full capacity. They also say a third of their capacity has been taken down because of conversion to renewable fuel production, as you talk about that transition. So they say that's stopping them. A letter from the head of the American Petroleum Institute says this: your administration has restricted oil and natural gas development, canceled energy infrastructure projects, imposed regulatory uncertainty, and proposed new tax increases on American oil and gas producers competing globally. So why should they take the risk, as we talked about, continuing to pour tens of billions of dollars into it? They say they lost tens of billions of dollars during the pandemic, as many people did, many industries did, and that they had to borrow against that tens of billions to ramp it back up and make sure they could produce now, but that you guys are handicapping them.
Well, again, what energy executives say is 94% of them say that there are other barriers other than federal regulation. But you have a president that says if there are practical and specific things that we can do in the immediate term, you raised refineries. About 1 million barrels a day of capacity came off. Companies took that offline during COVID. Some of that has been shifted to produce biofuels, but other facilities are standing idle. And what we're saying is, at a moment where these companies are generating record levels of profit because the prices have gone up because of the war over the last couple of months, put that investment to use. And if there are practical things that we can do, we're willing to listen and willing to be open. And over the medium term, this transition that we need to move through is a transition that the market recognizes. These companies recognize that's not a transition that happens overnight, but it is a transition that we all need to commit to.
Quickly, are you all worried about the optics of a visit to Saudi and looking like we're going sort of hat in hand, needing their help? Their human rights abuses are documented. The killing of journalist Jamal Khashoggi, there are real worries, and there are Democrats speaking out saying they don't think the president should be making this trip.
What's behind this is a very simple proposition, which is when it is in U.S. interest for the president to engage with a foreign leader, he will do so. If he believes he can advance U.S. national security interest and U.S. economic interest for American families.
Even though he said at one point Saudi Arabia should be treated as a, quote, pariah.
This trip where he's going to go to the Middle East, he's going to go to Israel and meet with a number of leaders is about exactly that. It's about advancing U.S. interests. We have significant interests, national security interests in the region, as well as economic interests as well. He will vigorously represent American interests while also vigorously representing American values. That's what you can expect from the president on this trip.
Okay. Brian, thank you very much for making the time. Good to have you on Fox News Sunday today.
Thank you.
We appreciate it. Up next, bipartisan talks on gun reform stall with negotiators still working out two major holdups. We'll bring in Senator Mike Lee on his concerns about the framework and whether he thinks we'll see a bill before the July 4th recess.
Fox News Sunday is brought to you by Charles Schwab. Own your tomorrow.
Your love life is important, but your schedule is busy. You don't have time to go to a doctor's office to get treated for your erectile dysfunction. Through Hims, now you can get treated for ED without stepping foot outside your door. Hims is changing men's health care by providing access to affordable sexual health treatments from the comfort of your couch. Hims provides access to doctor-trusted ED treatments such as chewable mints, brand-name treatments like Viagra, or generic alternatives for less. The process is simple and 100% online. No uncomfortable doctor's visits. Answer a series of questions on their site, and a medical provider will determine the right treatment option. If prescribed, your medication ships to you for free. No insurance is needed. If ED is getting you down, it's time to join the hundreds of thousands of trusted Hims subscribers and get treated. Start your free online visit today at hims.com/sunday. That's hims.com/sunday for your personalized ED treatment options. hims.com/sunday. Hard mints are chewable compounded products which are not approved by or verified for safety or effectiveness by the FDA. Prescriptions require an online consultation with a healthcare provider who will determine if appropriate. Restrictions apply. See website for details and important safety information. Subscription required. Price varies based on product and subscription plan.
For the first time in years, it appeared that a bipartisan agreement on gun reform was possible. 10 Republicans agreed to a framework, and even Senate Minority Leader Mitch McConnell expressed support. But some senators departed Capitol Hill this week frustrated with negotiations, and we still haven't seen the text of a bill. Joining us now from Utah, Senator Mike Lee, also the author of the book, Saving Nine. Senator, welcome back to Fox News Sunday.
Thank you.
All right, let's start. I want to put up on the screen here some of the framework for the gun legislation proposal. We don't have text yet, but it talks about funding mental health services, enhanced reviews for buyers, background checks on 18 to 21, things for school resources. There are also issues about red flag laws. I know that's one of the things that you and some other Republicans have been concerned about. But this is what the framework said when they announced it. It said it will help ensure deadly weapons are kept out of the hands of individuals who may court has determined to be a significant danger to themselves or others, consistent with state and federal due process and constitutional protection. So I hear the mention there of a court proceeding first and a recognition of due process. Can you support that?
Yeah, look, most of those things sound unobjectionable. The issue that we have here is that we don't have a bill. That's why I was surprised when last week, about a week ago, when you had this gang of 20 emerged saying, we have a deal. We started expecting to see a bill. Now, I personally refuse to indicate whether I or how I will vote on a bill until after I've seen the text, because there are a lot of things that can go wrong in legislation. I kept asking to see text, and it became apparent they didn't have a bill. In fact, they don't have a deal at all. What they had was agreement on a series of very broad promises. Now, I know there's some bill text that's probably been written, but on the most contentious, controversial, potentially impactful provisions, there is no language. Without that language, you can't ascertain whether it's okay. But, Shannon, the important thing here is we've got to be careful whenever something like this happens that we not legislate under the heat of the moment, under great emotion, without looking at the text and figuring out what we're doing. And we need to be careful that we not punish law-abiding Americans for the wrongs carried out by the criminally minded and the insane.
So Fox News polling shows that there is a lot of strength behind some of these proposals at this point, some of these proposals. Background checks for guns, which by and large, most of them are background checked before you do a purchase. 88%, though, moving the legal age for an assault rifle purchase is at 82%. Flagging for people who are a danger to themselves or others, those red flag laws, 81%. And banning assault weapons, 63%. There is a lot of momentum, at least among the public sphere, for doing this. Are you out of step with your constituents?
Okay, so first of all, what's important is that we look out for the rights of constituents. Constituents are asked poll questions. They're not asked questions about specific language within legislative text. It's the job of the lawmaker to look out for the interests and the rights of the law-abiding citizens they represent. And so with each of those provisions, I understand how they could get high popularity ratings when they don't define them. For example, you talk about banning assault weapons. There is no universal definition of what an assault rifle is. Very often the true distinction, it really depends on whether the stock pieces of the gun are made of wood or of plastic or of composite. So the text does matter here because it's that text that will determine whether we're intruding unduly on the rights of the American law-abiding citizen. And doing so in a way that would actually deter violent criminal behavior.
Yeah, I want to ask you, you referenced this a little bit earlier, some of the internal inner workings of these conversations about this. Axios is reporting it this way, saying essentially Senator John Cornyn, who is the lead Republican on these negotiations, they said that one senator called it, quote, shut up and vote, is what Republicans have been told to do. Axios also reported that you numerous times asked for more details, that you were rebuffed. And then they go on to quote a Cornyn aide who says this: he's been talking to and answering questions one-on-one from multiple of these members. He or our staff has been in particularly close contact with Crapo and Lee. So what is the deal? Are you getting answers to your questions, yes or no? Do you think this internal dialogue with the GOP may kill the whole thing?
No, not getting answers to my questions, not at all. Now, Senator Cornyn and others have been sincere in reaching out to us and having conversations, but I still have yet to see bill text. I still have yet to have any of my questions dealing with the details of what the provision would do answered. You know, it's one thing, Shannon, if they can identify with reasonable particularity what the provisions will do. They haven't even been able to do that. And that's what concerns me, is that this gang of 20 emerged saying we've got a deal. There was no bill. There still is no deal. And yet we continue to be asked by colleagues, by constituents, by reporters, are you supporting the bill? Just as a number of senators are rushing to sign on to the bill, to say they support the bill, when it doesn't exist. This is a very dangerous way to legislate. Well, and behind closed doors, you need the transparency of a public conversation with bill text in front of you.
Mm-hmm. Especially on an issue this big. Okay, I want to move to another top headline issue. The January 6th hearings continue to go on. What we heard this week is that the president had a number of his advisors tell him there was not enough evidence of fraud to change the election results to be in his favor for 2020. The president speaking out on that, the former president this weekend, here's what he said.
What you're seeing is a complete and total lie. It's a complete and total fraud.
All right, that's his take on it. Your own text messages have come up with respect to Mark Meadows. They've been highlighted. Here's what the Salt Lake Tribune said about that. Their headline, quote, new court filings raise questions about Senator Mike Lee's involvement in attempts to overturn the 2020 election. Your response?
Well, first of all, look, I knew how bad Joe Biden would be as president. I knew what a disaster he would be in the Oval Office. And there was some uncertainty in the wake of the election. As we approached the end of December, there were rumors that continued to circulate suggesting that some states were going to be reallocating, withdrawing and reallocating their electoral votes. Because Congress has a role in that, and I, as a senator, would be required to certify those, I wanted to find out. So I communicated with Mark Meadows to try to find out whether the rumors were true. I couldn't get answers, so I reached out to state lawmakers in various states, not trying to influence anyone, simply trying to find out whether the rumors were true. The rumors weren't true. No state had any intention of withdrawing its slate of electoral votes. And that made it an easy decision on my part to vote to certify the results of the election.
Has the committee asked to talk to you in the form of a deposition or otherwise? And would you sit down with them?
No, they haven't.
Would you sit down with them if they did?
Oh, sure. Look, I'd always be willing to talk if they want to talk.
Okay. Let's talk about one of our mutually loved issues out there, which is the Supreme Court. You clerked there. I just cover it and enjoy doing that. We're awaiting this decision. Your former boss, Justice Alito, the leaked opinion draft, if it holds true, will overturn Roe v. Wade. Listen, there have been protests that continue at the justices' homes. A guy has been arrested for plans to assassinate Justice Kavanaugh. Pro-abortion groups have declared literally, quote, open season on crisis pregnancy centers. There have been a number of attacks. Now, the FBI says it is investigating those attacks and those threats. The president this week signed a bill that will give more protection to justices' families. Are you satisfied that these threats, that these attacks are being handled properly?
No, I'm not. Because, Shannon, what we've seen is a deliberate attempt to isolate, demonize, and intimidate those justices considering signing Justice Alito's opinion, which everyone should read, by the way. It's fantastic. But as I predicted might be the case in my book, Saving Nine, that just came out a couple weeks ago, this would happen. They're trying to demonize them and intimidate them. The Justice Department has turned a blind eye to blatant violations of 18 U.S.C. Section 1507, the provision that prohibits people from showing up at the home of a Supreme Court justice to protest. And by not condemning those, by not prosecuting them, the Biden administration is propelling this and legitimizing the attacks.
Okay, we spent the top of the show talking about the economy with Brian Deese of the White House of the Biden administration. So I want to quickly ask you this. In a Washington Post article a couple weeks back, they said that even if Republicans get what they want, they don't have a plan for fighting inflation either. It says Republican politicians are instead fighting with Mickey Mouse, punishing immigrant children, complaining about fancy ice creams and Peloton, or otherwise waging culture war. So if Republicans do regain the House and or Senate, is there a GOP plan to get the economy kicking again?
Yeah, look, my plan is simple. We need to focus on regulatory reform as the first order of business. That would help bring down inflation. We need to pass the Reins Act, which would make it so elected lawmakers rather than unelected, unaccountable bureaucrats are passing our laws. Most of our laws, measured by volume, weight, word length, economic impact, you name it, are currently made by unelected, unaccountable bureaucrats. The Reins Act would fix that and bring down inflation.
All right, Senator Mike Lee, we will watch for the Supreme Court opinions again on Tuesday and Thursday this coming week. Thank you for your time.
Thank you, Shannon.
Up next, we're going to bring in our Sunday group on confidence in the Fed and prospects for a Trump-Biden rematch in 2024.
The question, really critical question from the perspective of doing our job, is making sure that the public does have confidence that we have the tools and we'll use them and they do work to bring inflation back down over time.
Fed Chief Jay Powell on what the Federal Reserve is doing to bring down inflation at a time when public sentiment is low and the notoriously nonpartisan organization's reputation is on the line. It is time now for our Sunday group. Catherine Lucy from The Wall Street Journal. Fox News contributor Ben Domenech, former Democratic Congressman Harold Ford Jr., and host of Media Buzz, Howie Kurtz. Welcome back, everybody. Good to see you today. Let's start there. Catherine, I want to start with you. The headline from Newsweek is the U.S. is already in recession, if the Atlanta Fed is right, because they've got their numbers out. It says America's almost certain to be in a recession when official figures are released, according to the early data. An update from the Federal Reserve Bank of Atlanta shows the economy on course for 0% growth in the second quarter of 2022. And that comes on the heels of negative GDP in the first quarter. What does this administration do? How worried are they about this?
Well, yeah, as you said also early in the show, a lot of CEOs also think that the country is ahead of a recession. I mean, the president did an interview this week with the Associated Press where he said that he does not see a recession as inevitable. They are citing, you know, strong jobs numbers, arguing that the country is in a better position than other nations around the world. And so they are, and they are also saying that they respect the Fed's independence as they try and, you know, work on interest rates. But certainly, you know, this is a real challenge for the president. He has a limited number of tools now to deal with what are most Americans' biggest concerns, you know, gas prices and inflation. They are trying to work to bring those things down. But they know that people are increasingly anxious and nervous, and you're driving past gas stations with $5 gas every day.
Yeah, and Harold, that was a more of a long-form interview that the president did with the AP. He hasn't been doing a lot of these, but he did say all kinds of interesting things where he admitted the American people, he said, are really down. He said that more than once, but he's asking them to have confidence in the economy, although in their real life it just doesn't resonate with them. Should he be doing more of these interviews or not?
He should. First, happy Father's Day to the men around the table, and fathers everywhere, and particularly to the guys in Ukraine. The president needs to lead more. I think when they put him out to react to things, I think it demeans the office and demeans him. You can't come out one day and say you're going to go see the Saudi Arabian leadership with the hope that they're going to produce more gas products and then criticize U.S. energy companies. That should stop. You should give them the certainty that they need. I listen to Brian. I think he's right in large part about the numbers are better than we think. But you can't tell a person who believes he or she's not doing well that you're doing much better. There's a long list of politicians who lost big races doing that. So if I were the president, I'd talk about the energy things he wants to do, which is to, look, give them the certainty around leases and regulations that they want. Repurpose some of the COVID money to help build out advanced manufacturing centers so we in cities across the country, from Chattanooga to Chicago to Cleveland, that will allow us to be less reliant on global supply chains. And then repurpose some of that money to pay down the debt. I, too, thank Joe Manchin. He was a big part of why things are not worse. But I just wish the president would lead more. Putting him in a reactionary mode doesn't do him well and certainly doesn't show well for the office.
All right, so Harold, we're going to put you in the column of Joe Manchin did the right thing on Build Absolutely. Back Better. Well, and, you know, Ben, Brandy's talked about the fact that they are in negotiations with congressional leadership, with top Democrats, about getting something across the line they think will help on this front. But as Bloomberg reported, Joe Manchin is again at the very center of those conversations. So how do they get this done before an August recess or before a potential change, midterm change?
I don't think that they're going to get it done. But even if they do, I think the problems that we're facing right now are more holistic than anything that Washington can solve in the near term. You know, Derek Thompson over at The Atlantic calls it the end of the everything boom, that essentially with money being so cheap for so long that you could afford to invest in these companies that were essentially working at a net loss, you know, selling people goods at far under the amount that it actually takes to make those goods or serving them in ways, you know, at a much lower cost than they could possibly justify. And now you don't have that luxury anymore. And the Fed is basically saying this needs to stop. They're sending the message that this can't keep going the way it's been going. That's going to affect so many different aspects of our economy. It's going to affect every different kind of household, whether you're someone who is experiencing this in terms of the high cost of things that you're seeing go up all around you, not just energy, or whether you're going to experience that because, you know, the Uber that you're taking is costing twice as much as it used to cost. What you're doing right now is being exposed to a reality about the way that our economy has been performing. And I think that, unfortunately, neither the White House nor Congress is going to have a solution in the immediate term, and that we really are headed for a couple of really hard years in a lot of respects.
Yeah, that's getting most of the headlines, but Howie, the January 6th committee, getting the rest of the headlines, it seems like this week, the bulk of them. It's been criticized for being put together as a TV production, but, you know, they got a former ABC executive over there. I mean, that was kind of the whole idea. You've watched every second of this thing, so what do you make of how it's playing?
Well, the hearings themselves have been uneven, often dull television at various points, but they've driven home this point. The witnesses who testified that Donald Trump was told by them that he had lost the election, that Trump knew that he lost the election, that the election fraud allegations that he continues to push were false, and that he endangered Mike Pence's life. They're all Republicans. They're Trump appointees, Trump advisors, at one point even his daughter. And so they're not fake news journalists. And so I think there's been a little bit of a shift now, journalists claiming vindication really by saying, see, we told you all along this was a big lie, and here are people who are sympathetic to Trump, who are part of his inner circle, saying the very same thing. And I think that will outlast the fact that it didn't get huge ratings. Now, did Liz Cheney and the Democrats on this committee change many minds? No. Everybody's dug in, but I do think we're seeing a shift in the coverage.
Well, and one of the things that's been part of the conversation is this now relationship between the DOJ and the committee about, are you going to turn over material? Because the DOJ says, you're not cooperating with us. We could use this for prosecutions that we're doing. A little bit of daylight, it seemed like, between the chair and the vice chair on the committee, Catherine. I mean, what are the potential legal and political, you know, ramifications of this?
Yeah, we're going to have to see how that plays out, right? They certainly are. DOJ is pushing to see if there's more they can get. The committee obviously is focused, I think, on trying to tell this story. They have more hearings to come. They really are trying to lay out in very stark terms what they say the president was doing on that day, you know, what the impact was and what this means for the American people. So we'll have to see how that comes together, I think, in the coming days and weeks.
Okay, we're all sort of inside the Beltway in various times in most of our lives. But I got to tell you, when I'm outside of it, I don't hear a lot of people who know about these hearings.
No,
what's happening?
Well, I think what's happening is that these are not working in a form of trying to change the conversation or change the minds of anybody in the country right now, in part because their mind is set on the economic challenges that we're facing. You're concerned about kitchen table issues. And I think that, frankly, if they had turned this committee around within 6 months after the January 6th incidents, then I think you would have had more response to it. But it took so long that it's now basically a production that is just designed to play for cable channels as opposed to change people's minds.
Yeah, I get the politics and I understand things may not be changed. But here's what I can't get my arms and my head wrapped around. The president knew for 4 hours that somebody could have died in that place. I worked in that Capitol, which we see in the background there. If someone had been killed that day, we'd be having a very different conversation. We have something in the law called attempted murder.
But yeah. We did now, have someone killed that day. Ashley
Babbitt. Let me not make light of anyone's life, but if a member of Congress or the vice president had been killed, we'd be having a different conversation.
Entirely.
I just think the deterrence around this, and I don't know what the answer should be. I'm not convinced that the Justice Department should act. But I do know, how do you deter something like this from happening again? And that's what I think we've got to think about as a nation, whether it's we're not thinking about as much as, because I think Ben is right. We're thinking about our economics and our own home economics in many ways. But I just can't get my head around, how would you let someone go over who said they wanted to kill your vice president and you didn't call him? And you didn't say, look, they're on their way, please leave. If I disagree with how we invent sometimes, but I would never if I knew that someone was coming to their home.
We got to leave it there. But, I mean, clearly there is more to come on that and more hearings to come, which we will continue to cover. All right, panel, taking a break. Up next, Fox News Sunday takes you to a cafe where a group of regulars has a decades-long tradition of talking politics. Get this, without problems. We're going to go there on the road to the midterms. Fox News Sunday is on the road to the midterms as Virginia voters prepare to head to the polls on Tuesday. Virginia is home to many of the Washington area's most pugnacious fighters, but it's also home to a lot of folks tired of the partisan bickering both online and in person. Alex Hoff takes us to a small county just beyond the Beltway where, at one small diner, civility gets the most likes.
It's 9 o'clock on a Monday morning in Berryville, Virginia, where commuters have long since merged into morning traffic, where the boys on the soccer team are state champs.
My grandma's coleslaw, that's it.
And where coleslaw is folded by hand, as it has been in Jane's Lunch for 80 years. Here, customers seat themselves.
Come on, Hack.
As this group does every weekday.
Can be 3 or 4, up to 12.
Like Clark County as a whole, the majority of these longtime friends are conservative.
Don't you think we get along pretty good, each other? You know, yeah. I might argue with him about something, but it's nothing important.
This tradition of diners gathering for a daily chat here started in the 60s and just kept going.
There were different business people that they would take a break about 10 in the morning and come down and have coffee.
These days, as gas and grocery prices rise, the conversation can get political, even heavy at times.
When little kids can get a gun, and go out and shoot people, that's not supposed to be like that.
The Second Amendment has a lot of different things, not just having guns. It's part of protecting this country, and has been from the very beginning.
So when hot-button issues come up, like perhaps immigration or abortion, they have a fine-tuned pivot.
So what do grandkids do this weekend?
Located about 60 miles outside of Washington, D.C., Berryville is a small town with just about 4,500 people. It's nearly doubled in size since 2000, as Beltway buyers moved further and further out and became Blue Ridge buyers, pushing prices higher.
70% of our buyers, I would say, are coming from Fairfax and Loudoun County. Cheaper taxes, prices, of course, are better.
Our diners felt the slow political changes that arrived along with new neighbors.
The people here don't want those kind of issues coming across the mountain.
I like Berryville, as Berryville is.
Berryville sits at the base of the Blue Ridge Mountains in Clark County, but right over that mountain is Loudoun County, which is largely considered a suburb of Washington, D.C.
While Clark County is a deep red, nearby Loudoun County is purple. Loudoun is part of the 10th Congressional District.
My name's Hung Cao. I'm running for Congress.
Awesome.
Republican Hung Cao is running against Democrat incumbent Jennifer Wexton.
My blood is red, white, and blue.
He's a veteran and Vietnamese immigrant and says the 10th District's growing immigrant population will give him a boost.
As we saw with the Governor Youngkin campaign, he made this appeal that seemed to draw in moderates. Do you think you'd be able to do the same thing?
I think we all want the same thing, right? We want government to leave us alone, right? Let Americans be Americans.
Thank you so much.
We want government to stay out of our businesses, stay out of our homes, stay out of our schools, and stay the heck away from our kids. And I think that's all Americans can agree with that.
Back in Berryville, C.B. Chappell shows off a photo of his wife, Biba. He's a Republican, Biba, a Democrat.
Did she get in your head about some things where you were like, I agree with you?
No, neither one of us really changed. I mean, we were what we were. Thinking back on it, I was blessed.
Biba passed away last year. The Daily Breakfast providing both comfort and companionship in the loss.
We have friends. We're just friends.
Our diners wish there were more groups like this, talking politics with civility and staying close in the face of division.
Really genuine concern for each other.
Knowing they'll be back tomorrow at Jane's Lunch.
It just is good. It's a good place to live.
Alex Hoff reporting from Virginia. We're back now with the panel. And Harold, I want to go hang out with these people. Like, you see this and say, okay, we can have conversations. I think that most of America is like that. They can have conversations with their neighbors and have disagreements. But how do voters get that message to Washington? More of this, less of what's happening up here.
First of all, that reassures you about the country in a lot of ways. It's good to see. And if you go, I want to go. I think, too.
We'll all go together.
We need to elect more people like the people that were in that diner. Not that those exact people necessarily, but people who come to Washington and approach politics with an understanding like the late Mark Shields did, which was to listen, to debate, be serious, be civil, and understand that we're not going to agree on everything, but if we can find compromise, let's find compromise. I think people also want from their politicians leadership. And leadership is the best of it, shares credit and takes accountability when things are wrong. Doesn't blame everybody, doesn't blame others, doesn't blame their own party, other members outside the party. Try to get something done. That's what I heard most from those people. And if you go, I want to go with you.
Okay, we're road trip. We're going to lock it in. The extremes out there get the most attention, clearly, Ben. And we see people who have troubles, are disturbed. They focus on that stuff. We saw a racist mass shooting up in Buffalo. We have a guy threatening to kill Justice Kavanaugh. By the way, we have polling on whether or not people think it's appropriate or inappropriate to be at the justices' houses, which is still happening almost every night. They rotate. The justices have different nights where people show up. Overall, 55% said inappropriate, 37% said appropriate. But even if you want to take the party out of it, 62% of independents and even higher numbers say they don't think what's happening at the justices' homes is a cool thing.
Well, I think, unfortunately, while, as Harold says, you might want to see people who can come to Washington achieve some kind of compromise and work together, I think that after November, you're actually going to see a wave election that is going to send a lot of people to Washington who are here basically as avatars of the most extreme, the most high level, you know, hair on fire kind of approach to our politics, in part because people are desperately trying to achieve change. They're trying to achieve a different direction in Washington, and they've been throwing all sorts of different approaches to it. It's why Donald Trump ended up being elected president. And I think that they're desperate for that change at a time when such change might not be possible anymore, when it, you know, advancing any kind of significant legislation is just too much of a lift for Congress. And its inability to do its job in a way that is actually, you know, a process of leadership that achieves reform and new policies in ways that respond to the demands of the people is turning out to be a real challenge for America's government overall, regardless of your ideology.
So also in our polling, we're tracking how that generic congressional ballot is starting to line up, and it's tightening. Republicans still have an advantage, 47% to 43%, but that has tightened up quite a bit. Catherine, what does that say to you about the midterms?
I mean, it's tightened a little bit. I think it's worth seeing if that number continues. And one thing to note is that it's still a lower number than it was for Democrats or a generic Democrat in 2018, which was a good year for Democrats in the midterms. But I think if you step back and look at the whole poll, I went through the poll, it's still got a lot of warning signs for Democrats that are really serious that we've been talking about. You know, voters are very unhappy with how Biden is handling inflation, about gas prices. The president's approval rating remains low, and people are citing gas prices as one of their top concerns. You know, so those things all line up for Democrats in a really troubling way. I mean, and they are issues that it's very hard for them to show a lot of movement on, and the country's really frustrated. As you mentioned, Biden said this week in an interview, you know, the country's really, really down. And so, you know, you're gonna have to see if that number has to tighten a lot more, I think, to account for that.
Okay, so we have heard a lot of whispering amongst all the frustration, Howie, about all of these growing numbers of articles. Some people on the record publicly saying, others privately saying they don't think that President Biden should run again and whether he should. The Atlantic, a writer over there, not exactly a conservative publication, said, let me put this bluntly, Joe Biden should not run for re-election in 2024. He is too old. What do you make of all these whisper campaigns and coverage on that front?
They are getting a lot louder. By the way, there's a lot of anger out there, too, amplified by the media and social media and, of course, our political system. There was a New York Times story a few days ago that was just an absolute game changer, because here you have the Times saying, quoting Democrats on the record as saying they have doubts about Joe Biden's age, his mental acuity, many saying he should not run for a second term. This is his own party. And it kind of got the story through customs. It made it safe for everybody else to talk about it.
Right.
You turn the TV,
people
like David Axelrod saying he's not as agile in front of a camera as he used to be, and he'll be closer to 90 than 80 at the end of a second term. So the White House takes this very seriously, attacked the story as salacious. Actually, it was reporting. And the thing is, you know, you've heard a lot of these things from conservative media. Now you have everybody talking about it. It's not good for Joe Biden. And officials take this so seriously that they obviously cooperated with the Washington Post piece yesterday saying, oh, no, Joe Biden is running. He's going to announce next year. We're all set. This is a guy who's wanted to be president since 1987 when he dropped out of his first campaign, which I covered. He doesn't want to give up this job, but he doesn't have the full support of his party right now.
Okay, but Harold, where does the party go? Because there are concerns and whispers about the vice president as well, and whether the field would completely open up if the president decided not to run again.
It's hard to see President Biden not seeking re-election. I would say if gas prices were down, food prices were down, people felt confident, people wouldn't be as bothered by some of these things. They'd say, wow, he knows exactly what he's doing, a stumble up the stairs, a little stumble over words, it doesn't matter. They've got to get the policies right. I'd be focused there as opposed to trying to respond to mental and physical acuity. Get the policy acuity right. You do that, people will begin to think and talk differently.
You got 5 seconds, Ben.
I'll just say that when Bernie Sanders did that debate with Lindsey Graham that Brett Baer hosted, he looked a lot livelier than Joe Biden.
Oh, boy. Okay.
Does that mean you go support Bernie Sanders?
I'm not saying that.
Okay, panel, thank you very much. We'll see you next Sunday. Up next, a final word on the week ahead.
Fox News Sunday is brought to you by Charles Schwab. Own your tomorrow. The first episode of Fox Nation's Duck Family Treasure. For one night only on Fox News Channel, the Robertsons are back, and you don't want to miss their newest adventure.
This is the real deal.
Catch the first episode of Fox Nation's Duck Family Treasure tonight on Fox News Channel. Brought to you by Camping World.
That's it for today. I'm Shannon Bream. Happy Father's Day to all you dads out there. I'll see you tomorrow and every weeknight for Fox News at Night, 12 a.m. Eastern on Fox News Channel. Have a great week. We'll see you next Fox News Sunday.
Listen to the all-new Brett Baer podcast featuring Common Ground, in-depth talks with lawmakers from opposite sides of the aisle, along with all your Brett Baer favorites like his all-star panel and much more. Available now at foxnewspodcasts.com or wherever you get your podcasts. Listen to Fox News Sunday ad-free on Amazon Music with your Prime membership or subscribe wherever you get your podcasts.